Welcome to the History of the Americans podcast, episode 145. I'm your host, Jack Henneman, and I'm recording this episode on March 11th, 2024, in Austin, Texas. We are telling the history of the lands now encompassed by the United States from the beginning without intentional presentism. I suppose it must be said up front that even though it is now March and this episode is history and involves women, it's absolutely not the Women's History Month episode of the podcast. I don't know if there will be a Women's History Month episode of the History of the Americans podcast, but if I make one, I can assure you it won't be about witches. Even I am not that devil-may-care. It's the late 1640s, more than 40 years before Salem's bull market in witches. Witches popped up on the banks of the Connecticut River in William Pynchon's town of Springfield, Massachusetts Bay Colony. This is the story of a brickmaker named Hugh Parsons and his wife Mary, and the ugly collapse of a tough marriage on the edge of the wilderness in Puritan New England. Insofar as this episode assumes some familiarity with early Springfield and William Pynchon, it would behoove you to listen to our episode from the end of January 2024, The Life and Times of William Pynchon, before you get to this one. In that episode, I referred to Pynchon's investigation of accusations of witchcraft against the Parsons, and I promised to come back to it in the future. This is the fulfillment of that promise. The main sources for this episode are David Power's book, Damnable Heresy, William Pynchon, the Indians, and the first book banned and burned in Boston, and The Ruin of All Witches, Life and Death in the New World, published by Malcolm Gaskill in 2021. Gaskill's book in particular is delightful to read, and I think most fans of the podcast would enjoy it immensely. Witches, it should be said, had been a very big deal in continental Europe for more than 300 years. From roughly 1300 to 1650, Europeans executed between 200,000 and 500,000 people for witchcraft, perhaps 85% of whom were women. At the midpoint of those ranges, that's 1,000 people a year and a population of 60 million or so, or 1.7 per 100,000 people. At that time, there were an estimated 50 to 100 murders per 100,000 people in at least some European countries. So the execution of witches was by comparison a drop in the bucket. Still, if say California and Texas, which are around the same population as medieval Europe, were burning or decapitating or hanging two or three witches a day, day in and day out, we'd find that disconcerting, almost no matter the background rate of murder. Here at the History of the Americans podcast, we contextualize with the best of them. England largely missed out on the medieval witch-burning craze. According to Nachman ben Yehuda, who published a paper in the American Journal of Sociology in 1980 on the European witch craze, quote, "In England, the witch craze started and ended later than in continental Europe, and was much milder. There, a demonological ideology did not prevail, and persons accused of witchcraft were considered to have committed crimes against men and not against God. Furthermore, in England, the judicial system was more humane than in Europe. It appears that during the 14th to 17th centuries, England was in many respects outside the dispute which tore Europe apart." Back to me. We shall see if Professor Ben Yehuda is entirely correct in this. In particular, the authorities in New England were quite concerned with offenses against God. That may, however, be a quibble. His final point that the English judicial system was more humane than in most places on the continent was also true in New England, even in the case of Hugh and Mary Parsons. In the end, the magistrates of the Massachusetts Bay would be far more concerned with a confession of infanticide than weighing the evidence for witchcraft. In the mid-1640s, Springfield was a village at the edge of the New England wilderness. It sat on the east bank of the Connecticut River above the fall line, in territory that came under the jurisdiction of the Massachusetts Bay Colony. It had been founded in 1636 by the fur trader, merchant, and amateur theologian William Pynchon, precisely because it was at the edge of the wilderness. His purpose was to leapfrog other English settlements and get closer to the supply chain for beaver pelts and other fur coming from the north and west. Pynchon controlled the economy of Springfield, and indeed the whole region, to such a degree that some of the Indians in the area referred to the English in general as Pynchon's men. There was very little actual cash money in circulation, so virtually any transaction that was anything more than barter between individuals was recorded as a debit or a credit in Pynchon's account books. He ran a general store full of imports he had acquired in exchange for furs he had purchased from Indians and sold in London. If people needed something, European cloth, nails, medicines, a gun, or anything else, Pynchon would sell it to them and record a debt. The locals would repay that debt with something they had produced, maize or pigs or chickens or bricks, or work it off by helping bring in Pynchon's crops or mending fences or standing watch. By this means, Pynchon became one of the wealthiest men in New England. To our delicate modern sensibilities, this makes Pynchon sound like a rapacious capitalist, out to exploit people who had no choice. He was indeed a careful and ambitious merchant trader, but he was also a student of law, as most men of property had to be in those days, and the town magistrate. He enforced justice with a scrupulous commitment to objectivity and was generally considered to deal fairly. And it should be said, everybody in Springfield was there voluntarily, insofar as they were always free to go seek their fortune elsewhere if they did not like Pynchon's system. If they didn't, it was because they found Springfield more comfortable than other places. It was, in some respects, one of the less intolerant places in either Massachusetts or Connecticut. If one wanted at least some tolerance and the opportunity that came with owning one's own land, Springfield was a pretty good option in the mid-1640s. One of the reasons why Springfield was a bit more open than Boston and Connecticut was that Pynchon himself was a heterodox thinker, at least by the standards of New England outside Providence and Rhode Island. The town's minister, George Moxon, was Pynchon's friend and himself open to ideas that were considered heretical in Boston. Pynchon would go on to write a book that challenged the orthodox belief that Jesus redeemed humanity by his death and visit to hell, and Moxon would arrange for a relative to publish it in London. That book, The Meritorious Price of Our Redemption, would become the first book banned in Boston and eventually lead to Pynchon's return to England. It was therefore arguably surprising that one of the first notorious witchcraft cases would arise in Springfield. To understand why it did, we must understand what a scary and downright mysterious place Springfield would have been roughly 380 years ago. One of the great strengths of Martin Gaskell's book, The Ruin of All Witches, is its setting of the scene, the context in which the accusations against the Parsons arose in Old Springfield. The town, having been established for fundamentally commercial reasons, attracted hardworking and intensely ambitious people. In Gaskell's words, quote, "few Springfield folks would have admitted it. But burning ambition, made possible by Pynchon's power yet also constrained by it, undermined community and piety. The worst sin, apart from murder or witchcraft, was idleness." Gaskell devotes a couple of pages to describing daily life in Springfield, and it's so evocative an image of 17th century New England on the frontier that I'm going to quote a good bit of it here. No doubt much of Gaskell's description applied elsewhere on the edges of North American settlement in those years, even if different in intensity and mood. One can imagine, for example, the Swedes on the Delaware or the Dutch on the edge of Mohawk country living much the same way. Quote, from March to September, the working day lasted between 10 and 16 hours, 4:30 a.m. to 8:30 p.m. Shadows marked time. At noon, a man could step on his own head. Field work was paid at twice the rate in England, which had a surfeit of workers. There was no clear division of labor. Men might be artisans and farmers, like Hugh Parsons, and still do jobs for pension. They toiled in enervating heat and bone-chilling cold, felling timber, excavating stumps, sawing planks, splitting shingles, breaking rocks, digging drains, diverting streams, shoring banks, building bridges, and laying causeways. They mowed meadows, stacked hay, and boxed pine trees for pitch and resin. Boxing a tree is to drill a hole for the purpose of draining sap. Back to Gaskell. They tended cattle and sheep, netted pigeons, and caught fish on deerskin lines, as the Indians had taught them. As well as wheat, barley, oats, flax, and hemp, they grew maize. They learned the Indian tricks of planting when white oak leaves were as big as a mouse's ear, using fish as fertilizer. Dogs' paws were tied to their collars to stop them digging it up, and growing pumpkins, squashes, and beans between the tall stems. At the end of the six-day week, laborers rested aching muscles and rubbed grease into cracked hands. The Sabbath, kept holy by law, began at sunset on Saturday and ended the following night. At home, men made furniture, whetted saws and axes, twisted rope, and sewed sacks. They chopped firewood, repaired roofs, daubed walls, pruned trees, trimmed hedges, cleared paths, scoured ditches, and maintained fences that were, so the saying went, hog tight, horse high, and bull strong. Hugh Parsons did all of these things. Pigs were slaughtered under a waning moon to prevent, or so it was believed, the pork swelling in the barrel. Nothing was wasted. The offal eaten at once, intestines stuffed with fat and blood for sausages, bacon smoked from the chimney lug pole, bladders were receptacles for lard. Wives like Mary Parsons made hog's hair twine for sewing buckskins. They also tended orchards and helped with harvest, threshing and winnowing, and made hay. In the process, they too suffered from sunburn and chilblains, back pain and sprains. They foraged for herbs and nuts, grew carrots, cabbages, and turnips, fed hens and geese, and milked goats and cows. Household chores were just as arduous. Laundry was heavy lifting, and caring for children went on all day, as did cooking. Stewing, baking, roasting, frying, pickling, brewing. Women spun hemp and flax, knitted stockings and gloves and carded wool. They sewed and patched and darned. As much as possible was done together outdoors, husking maize or stitching quilts or burying while sharing stories and news, the more fanciful and grotesque, the better for relieving the tedium of repetitious tasks. Back to me. If you've ever wondered what the Industrial Revolution has done for you, consider what your life would have been like in the 17th century. History teaches both humility and, if one is open to it, gratitude. Back to Gaskell. The comfort of daylight was eked out with puffed up embers, tallow candles and pine slivers, rich in turpentine and pitch, burning brightly in clay dishes. Laboring couples like Hugh and Mary Parsons went to bed as soon as their chores were done. The best bed was usually in the hall near the fire, sometimes behind a wooden screen or in the parlor, which might have its own smaller fireplace. Most workers, exhausted, fell asleep at once. Others lay awake listening to rodents scratching in the eaves and rafters. Occasionally, snakes slithered in. For every home had its weak points. Windows, doors, and chimneys opened to the sky. Demons, too, crossed boundaries. Households were imagined as models of the state and vice versa. And bodies and homes similarly corresponded. The hearth as the heart, the rooms like limbs, and windows eyes. Preachers likened souls to castles unlocked by wicked thoughts to let in diabolic enemies without a fight. Dreams extended a real world of danger into an imaginary one. The minds of sleeping colonists were transported to a place where the wilderness met the invisible realm and received supernatural revelations encoded as symbols of civility and savagery, angels and serpents, Christians and heathens. Here, the devil turned fantasy into fact and made witches of the weak by convincing them they had acquired his power. Everything was polarized between good and bad, day and night. As one New Englander declared, "I saw my hellish, devilish nature opposite to God and goodness, between light and darkness." Satan was not God's equal adversary. The idea was heretical, but more like a pet ape on a long chain, bestial yet restrained and judiciously used by God to tempt sinners. The Calvinist doctrine of predestination held that some souls, the elect, were destined to rule as saints at the millennium, and the rest, the reprobate, were irredeemably damned. Yet even the elect needed to find their inner grace through contemplation and by avoiding sin. Not that this was easy. Humans were frail, whereas demons were cunning and relentless. Back to me. It's difficult today to truly grasp how exhausting and downright scary daily life was in old Springfield. One might even say it was traumatic, however depreciated that word might be today. But Gaskell's description transports us there. It's now a bit less difficult to imagine how people who were prone to depression or anxiety might have behaved in that world, and that brings us to Hugh and Mary Parsons. Mary Parsons was born around 1610 in Wales, probably to a family named Rees. In her late teens, about 1627, she married a Catholic man named David Lewis. David publicly conformed to the Church of England, but secretly worshipped as a Catholic. He demanded that his new wife convert and threatened Mary when she resisted. He and his sisters made her life a living hell, but divorce was not possible. She might have fled, but around 1637, after 10 years of childless and emotionally barren marriage, it was David who abandoned Mary, leaving her all alone. Still, she searched for her vanished husband by every means at her meager disposal. She started attending the church of the minister William Roth, who would be the only man ever to go out of his way to be kind to her. Roth, who had himself been drifting toward Calvinism, believed she had made every effort to find her husband and save her marriage, and having failed, encouraged her to start a new life in New England, as many others were doing in those years of the Puritan Great Migration. He introduced her to another minister who knew William Pynchon and arranged for her to work in his household in Dorchester, Massachusetts Bay, which Pynchon then still kept while he built up in Springfield. Mary Lewis sailed for Boston and her new life in the summer of 1640. In the spring of 1641, Pynchon had Mary travel the Bay Path, 100 miles of old trail from Boston to Springfield. She almost certainly walked with a group, since it would not have been safe for a woman alone, especially since it passed through the territory of at least 4 Indian nations. When she arrived at Springfield, it had a total population of perhaps 45 people. She went to work for Pynchon's daughter and son-in-law, Anne and Henry Smith, and took care of their 2 daughters, Anna and Mary. Now more than 30 years old, Mary Lewis became a nanny and a housekeeper. Anne was pregnant again and soon gave birth to a 3rd daughter, Martha, on July 31, 1641. Sadly, her 2nd daughter, Mary, fell ill and died shortly thereafter. The death of a child hurt the parents as it does today. The difference, perhaps, was that it was so common then that everybody else in town would have truly understood the pain of it. And that there must have been at least some small comfort. Mary's life, like everybody's, was more or less endless work. The long, dark New England winters, though, left a bit more time for leisure. Then, as now, people went to the tavern, which then was called an ordinary, meaning licensed ale house. There they drank ale or hard cider and smoked tobacco, which was, by then, as now, grown along the Connecticut River south of Springfield. Also then as now, drinking and smoking were not popular with the scolds, quoting Gaskell. Smoking was popular, although some disparaged it as a savage Indian pastime. Drunkenness was punished, as was singing filthy, corrupting songs, an English practice not tolerated in Massachusetts. Drinking healths was reviled as the sort of thing one might find, so one Puritan said, at the conventicles and festivals of witches. The militia always drank on training days, that strikes me as ill-advised, without which busy farmers considered such events a waste of time. Alcohol started fights and made courting couples sin. Intimacy required privacy, so in fine weather, young people slipped into the woods and meadows. Grass stains told tales on young women who wore the, quote, green gown, which might be a risk worth taking to secure a husband. Better a green gown than to remain a spinster and be mocked as a thornback. Back to me. A thornback was slang for a sea skate with a thorny spine, so it was not, shall we say, a nice thing to call a spinster. Mary was, for all intents and purposes, well on her way to becoming a spinster. She'd kept her marriage back in Wales a secret, but that did not make her any less eager to find a man to love and protect her. In 1645, 4 years after Mary came to Springfield, a new and single man arrived in town. His name was Hugh Parsons, and Mary thought he was to die for. She was not, it would turn out, exactly wrong. In a world of wooden buildings and the constant need of wood fire for cooking and heating, proper bricks were very important, especially for chimneys. Wooden chimneys lined with clay were not safe, even by the standards of a very unsafe world. The problem was, good bricks were not easy to make, and the making of bricks was a particular skill. One had to find the right clay, clean it, and drain it properly over a long period of time, and then mix it, mold it into bricks, and fire those bricks very precisely in a kiln. Even then, many finished bricks were flawed and not suitable for bearing the load required by a chimney. Ordinary farmers could not make good bricks. It was the job of a specialist. In 1645, Boston had plenty of brickmakers and bricks and had banned wooden chimneys. But Springfield had no bricks, except a very few imported at great expense over all that distance for Pynchon and a couple of other of the wealthiest settlers. In 1645, Pynchon recruited a brickmaker to Springfield, Hugh Parsons. We do not know where Parsons came from, but probably one of the other settlements in New England. What we do know is that he quickly sized up Mary Lewis as cute and available, and she thought the same of him. Parsons was ambitious to improve his lot, as virtually everybody in old Springfield was. Parsons somehow came across as more ambitious than the norm. He was an incredibly hard worker, also more so than typical in Springfield, difficult as that may be to believe. Finally, he was something of an odd duck, with a conspiratorial mind, quick temper, and weird propensity to mutter darkly about getting even when he believed that somebody had done him wrong. It was unlikely that any of this was immediately obvious to Mary Lewis. Mary, however, had that secret. Perhaps because she now thought of Hugh as a prospect, she confessed her abandoned marriage to her boss, Ann Smith, who was Pynchon's daughter. Was Mary eligible to marry again? Anne was sympathetic and brought the question to Pynchon, who took Mary's testimony and wrote the authorities in Boston for a ruling. After some months of follow-up correspondence, Mary was found to have done all that could be done to find her husband and was authorized to marry again. Hugh and Mary were duly married, and in June 1646, not much more than a year after Hugh's arrival in Springfield, Mary gave birth to their daughter, Hannah. Adding up the months it took for Mary to obtain permission to remarry, it seems possible she had herself worn the green gown. Around the time that Mary and Hugh were tying the knot, stories of witches were rising in both England and New England. Just as continental Europe was winding up its centuries of witch burning, England started seeing witches hunched over every cauldron. In the eastern counties of England, more than 200 suspects had been arrested, many of whom, in the words of Malcolm Gaskell, had made dire confessions. Quote, sealing diabolic covenants, suckling familiar spirits, and bewitching neighbors, these fantastical claims had hardened into convincing reality in the courtroom, especially because they came from the witch's own mouths. One woman admitted that a creature like a large brown mouse had woken her from a dream by nipping her, and it demanded a portion of her soul. At first, she resisted, but soon accepted two imps as her personal gods, one for killing cattle, the other men. This contributed to widespread consternation in Old England, which had also experienced prodigious rainbows and suns, blood-red rain and thunder-like gunfire, as well as monstrous births. Closer to home in Connecticut, there was also talk of horror crimes in the godly town of New Haven. Witchcraft, heresy, blasphemy, bestiality, and rape. The governor's wife had been excommunicated for malicious conduct, including falsely accusing her own stepdaughter of being in league with Satan, and her servant of bewitching the beer. Back to me. Somebody back in Connecticut should start a craft brewery and name it Bewitched Beer Works. Thank me in advance. No need for a royalty. Closer to Springfield, news came from Hartford of a woman named Alice Young who'd been hanged as a witch. In June 1648, the good people of Boston hanged Margaret Jones as a witch on the common. In late 1648, the Connecticut River town of Wethersfield, then still under the tough ministry of Thomas Hooker, condemned Mary Johnson to death for confessing under grueling interrogation that she'd so often cursed in Satan's name, that he would sometimes materialize and help her with her chores. In that, Satan was setting a good example for husbands everywhere, but Hooker did not see it that way at all. By the time little Hannah Parsons was toddling along, therefore, witches and their doings were creeping into the thoughts of the godly and fearful people of Springfield. People began to look upon strange events, moments that ordinarily would be fodder for lighthearted gossip, as evidence of something worse. Witches, perhaps. During these first years after the birth of Hannah, the marriage of Hugh and Mary Parsons began to fray, a little at first and then rapidly. Hugh felt ever greater pressure to provide for his family and realize his frankly modest material ambitions. He drove himself ever harder, taking on additional work. Hugh would come home long after sundown, grumpy and exhausted, complain that Mary was not holding up her end of the household work, and collapse into bed right after eating. He often slept poorly and would wake up with nightmares and say weird stuff in his sleep. Mary, who was never the soul of equanimity, became anxious and depressed. Perhaps she had postpartum depression, or maybe she was succumbing to that particular despair of people trapped in a bad marriage. Hugh, for his part, would materialize unannounced at the houses of others in town, perhaps to borrow a tool or renegotiate an agreement for bricks. Sometimes he would just sit down and start smoking his pipe. And sometimes, when he had a beef with the person he was visiting, would mutter dark threats about getting even. Hugh was angry and weird, however hard he worked and however essential his brickmaking was to the community. When strange things would happen after one of those threats, people would begin to wonder, in the recesses of their minds, if Hugh's revenge against them involved witchcraft. These thoughts would become more conscious as Mary Parsons began talking about witchcraft, probably in 1648, around the time she gave birth to the second Parsons child, a boy named Samuel. Mary focused her attention on a widow who had recently arrived with two teenage children in Springfield from the Connecticut River town of Windsor, Mercy Marshfield. The widow Marshfield did as neighbors had to do in those days. She threw herself into the small Springfield community to make friends. Everybody on the frontier needed a protective network of friends on whom they could rely, single women especially. As it happened, among Mercy's new friends was a woman named Blanche Bedortha, who was struggling with a difficult pregnancy. She'd exchanged unkind words with Hugh Parsons while he was rancorously negotiating with her husband, and he had insulted her in his weird, threatening way. Now she was ill and her baby was in peril, and she and her friend Mercy held Hugh responsible. Blanche's baby survived, but the gossip against Hugh Parsons accelerated every time something strange happened after a grumpy encounter with him. Gaskell goes through each such moment at length, but we'll have to settle for David Powers' summary in his biography of Pynchon. Quote, kitchen knives had been going missing from Griffin Jones' table when needed, then reappearing later. George and Hannah Langdon's puddings, oddly and neatly sliced in two. When the bags in which they'd been cooked were opened, not once but twice, a trowel was gone from where it had been left, just outside John Lombard's door, only to reappear on the lintel 3 days later. The milk from Sarah Edwards' cow was said to turn yellow and then change to other odd colors at each milking for a week. The sound of a saw being sharpened was heard under cover of darkness, and on a Sabbath no less, according to Benjamin Munn. And people were seeing things. Weird lights lit the night in Jonathan Taylor's bedroom, while a phantom dog terrified the 2-year-old son of Blanche and Reese Bedortha. Sometimes he thought he saw it under the stool, sometimes under the cradle. Back to me. By the spring of 1649, Hugh Parsons was, in Gaskell's words, repugnant in the eyes of the town. Mary was anxious and confused. Her marriage wasn't happy, but rumors about Hugh were fundamentally rumors about her. How could it be that she lived with a witch? She focused her ire on Mercy Marshfield, telling others that Mercy had taught her how to identify witches, the implication being that only a witch could do that, and asserting that down in Windsor it was well known that Mercy Marshfield bowed to Satan. For aught I know follows her here. Soon enough, in that tiny town, word of Mary's accusation got back to Mercy Marshfield, who promptly complained to William Pynchon. Claims of witchcraft notwithstanding, Pynchon viewed this as a defamation case, which it surely was. He set a trial date at the end of May 1649. Mary began to lose it. Now back to Gaskell, quote, shortly before her trial, Mary took her skeptical neighbor, John Matthews, aside for a quiet word. Her subject, as usual, was witchery. This time, however, she didn't repeat the charge against Mercy Marshfield. She had an even more devastating accusation, one that spoke loudly of her confusion and anguish, her growing obsessions about witchcraft, and the terror her strange husband instilled in her. To Matthew's astonishment, Mary accused Hugh himself of being a witch. There was always more going on behind his hard face than came out when he spoke, she said, which was increasingly rarely. Nor did he always attend Mr. Moxon's meetings, a disinclination that may have been entirely because he was working in the long meadow, or perhaps because Christian worship somehow pained him. So yes, Hugh was a witch, she was sure of it, but how could she be so certain, asked Matthews. She replied that Satan often came to him in the night to feed from his body, so that he was tormented in his bowels and cried out as though he were pricked with pins and daggers. He was hellishly ensnared, she believed, and now couldn't escape. As the proverb had it, it was easier to raise the devil than to lay him to rest. And the same was true of accusations of heinous crimes in a town like Springfield. By confiding in John Matthews, Mary had lit a fire. Back to me. After hearing testimony, Pynchon found Mary liable for having defamed Mercy Marshfield. He sentenced her to 20 lashes, but with an option to commute the sentence if she agreed to pay a fine of 3 English pounds to Mercy, payable in silver or 24 bushels of corn come harvest time. She chose the fine. Hugh, who genuinely worked to exhaustion barely to make ends meet, was furious. Mary's baseless gossip had cost him weeks of work. This was not a formula for marital reconciliation. In October 1649, after a long smallpox-infected summer that took its lethal toll on English and Indian alike and further amped the anxiety in Springfield, little Samuel Parsons, less than 2, fell sick of something else and suddenly died, seemingly like a bolt from the blue. Hugh was not at home. He hated being at home, and often spent the night under the stars at his field in the long meadow some distance away, so he could resume work at first light. His neighbor Jonathan Bird arrived to tell him that Samuel had died. Hugh said little in reply, and to Bert's great surprise evinced no emotion. He walked off toward George Colton's house, where he plopped himself down and started cutting tobacco for his pipe. "I hear my child is dead," he remarked, "but I will cut a pipe of tobacco first before I go home." Like Bert, the Coltons were appalled. Pipe duly smoked, he went home to find Mary sitting with Samuel's body and the neighbors around. He stayed a little while, again showing no emotion, and then got up and walked back to the long meadow to go back to work. However suspicious Hugh's neighbors had been, his reaction to Samuel's death was so cold that he seemed like a man possessed. Hugh Parsons was, to all appearances, a monster. That winter, Hugh Parsons came to Mercy Marshfield's door with the 24 bushels of corn he owed her because of the judgment against his wife. He begged her to cut him some slack. This was food the Parsons needed. But Mercy had none for Hugh. He flew into a rage and cursed her, saying that it shall be as wildfire in your house and as a moth in your clothes. This was botched scripture, probably echoing one of the Reverend Moxon's sermons. But Mercy came away terrified that Hugh had bewitched her family. Meanwhile, Mary's obsessions grew, particularly around Hugh's emotionless response to Samuel's death. She arrived at a single, terrible conclusion, that by consorting with dark forces, her husband had murdered their own son with witchcraft. Dark as their marriage had become, Hugh and Mary Parsons still had sex. Given how bad things were between them, one wonders whether it was consensual, or maybe it was, a desperate attempt to repair their relationship, or maybe just a sense of duty. A year after Samuel's death, in October 1650, Mary gave birth to a third child, another boy they named Joshua. Springfield got weirder in the brutally cold winter of 1651. The Indians were getting hostile, and disease again stalked the town. Various unlucky things happened to people who had had run-ins with Hugh, who himself was ever more exhausted and agitated. A couple of Scots arrived in town, told the story of witches in their own country. As many as 300 had been burned. Stories of witch hunts in Bermuda and much closer, Wethersfield, Connecticut, raised the anxiety even more. A couple of children died. In February, the ever-anxious Mary got a bit into her cups at the alehouse and darkly implied that Hugh may have been responsible. Now let's go back to Gaskell, quote, "At this point, Mary appeared to slip into a trance. She was glazed and unresponsive. What the company in the alehouse didn't know was that an infernal voice was booming inside her, a voice that only Mary could hear. Satan told her he had entered Hugh's body, not carnally, but through an invisible surge. In a quavering whisper, Mary admitted to the devil that she, too, might have become a witch before now had she not been so afraid. "I will not come in any apparition," Satan reassured her in his manly, masterful way, "but only come into thy body like a wind, and trouble thee a little while, and presently go forth again." She would be spared the usual diabolic consummation described by witches, the hot breath, damp skin, and icy semen. Nor would her blood, pricked by the devil's claw, be used to sign his ledger, an account book like pensions. At this moment, slumped in the Ashley's alehouse, Mary consented in her heart to Satan and was transported. Leaving her body in the room, her soul was whisked away to a witch's meeting in John Stebbins' home lot. It was dark there, but in the firelight she could make out her husband and two other witches, the constable's wife, Sarah Merrick, and Bess Sewell, the wife of another townsman. There was revelry and gleeful shape-shifting from human to animal forms, but the witches, angry with Mary for revealing so much, made her walk barefoot over the stony ground to gather sticks for the fire. Ever the wayward servant and disappointing wife, even in this fantasy world of escape from the mundane, she was being punished by her cruel husband and judgmental female neighbors. Back to me. At this point, all of this was still locked in Mary's mind, her trance terrifying the others in the bar. Then the bell signaling a meeting of the congregation rang, and Mary, still stunned, helped along by her neighbors, made it to the meeting. As word of her freaky trance spread, the townspeople were terrified. Rumors spread, and anything weird was attributed to Hugh's witchcraft. A few days later, on February 26, 1651, after the episode with the mysteriously split pudding and other strange affairs, people came to William Pynchon and lodged a formal complaint against Mary Parsons, accusing her of being a witch, just as she had accused Hugh and Mercy and increasingly others. Pynchon, who himself was now under the cloud of heresy, treated the complaint as judiciously as he was able. Witchcraft was a capital crime and therefore beyond his authority to adjudicate. The case would have to go to Boston. It was Pynchon's job to gather evidence, and this he did dutifully. He took statements from witnesses all over town and interviewed Mary, who told him of her vision. Pynchon issued a warrant for Mary's arrest. She was confined in Constable Thomas Merrick's house, and townsmen were assigned to keep watch over her in shifts. Would they see any actual evidence of demonic possession or telltale markings? Pynchon continued to take statements from witnesses, with all the old accusations against Hugh tumbling out, including from Mary. Within a couple of days, having taken 40 handwritten pages of testimony recounting all the many stories detailed in Gaskell's book, Merrick arrested Hugh. Now both the Parsons were in custody. In early March, Pynchon convened a public hearing to get more testimony that might be used to support a trial in Boston. Hugh was in the dock first. He stiffly responded to the charges against him, noting that none of the accusations were supported by two witnesses, the requirement under English law. When questioned about his lack of visible emotional response to the death of Samuel, he said that he was very full of sorrow, but in private, and in the moment he had felt so stunned by the news that all he could bear was to state the fact of it and throw himself into his work. I actually can imagine that. While all this was happening, baby Joshua, now only 6 months old, suddenly died. Everyone assumed Mary had murdered him, and she did not deny it. The contemporaneous note in the town register records only that, quote, "Joshua Parsons, the son of Hugh Parsons, was killed by Mary Parsons, his wife." Pynchon continued to take testimony, building his case file methodically and without apparent prejudice, the consummate magistrate in a world that took the offense of witchery seriously. Gaskell's account of that testimony and how it tied back to the many mysterious happenings now placed at the feet of Hugh Parsons is actually riveting and reason enough to read the book, which I highly recommend. Suffice it to say that, as interesting as it is, there's no way to give it justice in a podcast episode, other than to say that during the course of Pynchon's hearings, Mary confessed her own dalliance with Satan and to murdering her son. So it was, on March 24th, 1651, Mary and Hugh Parsons were bound at the hands and put together in a cart that would take them over the Bay Trail to Boston, 100 miles away. That must have been a beautiful moment for both of them. The two were put into the jail in Boston to wait their fate. Gaskell describes the jail as a sullen stone fortress with dripping walls 3 feet thick and doors of iron-studded oak that echoed like thunder when slammed. Contemporaries compared it to a grave for the living. It reeked of human waste and despair. Mary would be there only a few weeks, but Hugh would survive in that cold, dirty, nasty place for more than a year. His trial delayed because of the hassle in bringing a sufficient number of witnesses from Springfield. There were two courts in Boston in those days. The Court of Assistants, made up of magistrates, conducted trials. The General Court, which was essentially the legislature, also conducted trials and functioned as the Court of Appeals and approved judgments in capital cases. Perhaps because she had already confessed, the case of Mary Parsons went straight to the General Court on May 8, 1651. After some fits and starts because Mary had become very ill, the trial began on May 13th with John Endicott, whom we have seen many times, presiding. Longstanding and attentive listeners will remember that it had been Endicott, 15 years before, who had led the expedition to Block Island that triggered the Pequot War. What should have been a perfunctory hearing, Mary had, after all, confessed in Springfield, was turned into a full-blown trial when Mary retracted her confession and pled not guilty. No witch had been executed in Boston for 3 years, and the general court turned skeptical. It took the testimony of 30 townsfolk, but only 7 appeared to tell their story in person. The rest spoke only through Pynchon's record. There were, it turned out, insufficient eyewitnesses to convict Mary. Unbelievably to the people from Springfield who had experienced all that had transpired and come there to prosecute Mary, Endicott determined that the evidence offered was insufficient to support the charge of witchcraft, and he ordered that she be acquitted. Then the court turned to the charge of the murder of baby Joshua. The court asked her if she did it. The room fell silent. Mary looked stricken and was still so sick she could barely stand in the dock. The seconds ticked away, and then she said it. I'm guilty. She had confessed to killing her own baby. There would be no trial. John Endicott passed the sentence, quote, "You shall be carried from this place to the place from whence you came, and from thence to the place of execution, and then hang till you be dead." The date of her execution was to be May 29, 1651. Mary Parsons would not make it to the gallows. At some point between May 13th and May 29th, she died alone in prison, lying on filthy straw. Meanwhile, Hugh Parsons had languished in jail for almost 3 months. He was brought to trial in mid-June 1651. William Pynchon had left town, he having stood trial at the same time for his heretical book, The Meritorious Price of Our Redemption. Hugh's prosecutor would be Henry Smith, Pynchon's son-in-law and the original employer of Mary Lewis Parsons. Hugh Parsons stood at the bar, filthy in unwashed clothes and unkempt beard and hair from his months in jail. He listened to the indictment read against him, and with as much dignity as he could muster, pled not guilty. Again, the jury considered Pynchon's deposition transcripts and heard the testimony of the three witnesses who had come from Springfield. After deliberating, the foreman reported that while the evidence presented had impressed them with, quote, a deep suspicion of witchcraft, they viewed the scant in-court testimony as insufficient to support a conviction. Rather than acquitting Hugh, John Endicott suspended the hearings against the possibility of bringing more witnesses from Springfield. He went back to jail, where it would turn out he would languish for almost another year. His hearing resumed on the morning of May 12, 1652, in the Court of Assizes. More witnesses testified, but still, there was little corroboration of individual accusations by two witnesses. Again, the jury repaired to deliberate. Hugh's life hung in the balance. Finally, the foreman, one Edward Hutchinson, don't know if he's related to Anne, reported the unanimous decision of the jury, quoting Gaskell. Provided the general court accepted the scribal versions of Mary Parsons' confession, the accusations of alleged victims and other depositions as authentic testimonies according to law, without corroboration by witnesses before the court, then they were content to find Hugh Parsons guilty of witchcraft. Stunned, Hugh was carried back to jail, awaiting approval of the verdict. Boston citizens prepared for the hanging they had so greatly anticipated, and which Mary's untimely death had denied them. Back to me. Within 2 weeks, the pace of justice apparently accelerating, Hugh Parsons appeared before the general court. The judges, again dissatisfied with the quality of the evidence presented, found that the burden of proof had not been met under English law. Hugh Parsons was not guilty of witchcraft, at least as a matter of law, and was free to go. The evidentiary requirements of English common law and the intellectually honest enforcement of those requirements by judges who believed that the crime of witchcraft was an actual thing had again prevailed over the baying of the crowd for retribution. Young Hannah Parsons, now 6 years old, who had not seen either of her parents for more than a year, was taken to be with Hugh in Boston. John Pynchon, who'd been left in charge of Springfield when his father William returned to England, rather than recant his heresy to the satisfaction of the general court, settled Hugh's debts by selling off his property, finally returning a small sum of money to him. Hugh and Hannah lived in Boston for 6 more years, and then in 1658 moved to Portsmouth, Rhode Island, that indispensable refuge for the misfits of Puritan New England. Back to Gaskell for the coda, quote, "The unstinting devotion to work that had been Hugh Parsons' undoing in Springfield allowed him to rebuild his life in Portsmouth, and more than that, to prosper. He acquired land adjoining the estate of John Wood, one of John Winthrop's sea captains, married Wood's widow Elizabeth, and raised her daughters as his own. So Hannah Parsons, long an orphan of sorts, had parents and siblings again, and after her childhood trauma, something approximating to stability. Only now and then did her father cross his neighbors. He served as a juror, a deputy in the assembly, and a mounted trooper, the model of a respectable freeman of New England. If rumors of Hugh's past followed him there, they don't seem to have caused him any trouble. There was nobody to persecute witches in Portsmouth. Indeed, there were no witches at all. At the age of 24, Hannah Parsons married one Henry Madison, had 7 children, and lived a long and contented life. So too, it seems, did Hugh. He died on June 18th, 1685. Back to me. America, even then, was the land of second chances. May it always be so. This is a great place to stop right now. This episode, long as it is, cannot do justice to Malcolm Gaskell's work of deep history. If you buy it, consider doing so through the link on the website in the show notes for the episode. Again, thank you for listening to the History of the Americans podcast. Your emails have been very encouraging. Please keep them coming. You can reach me with questions, corrections, eruptions of indignation, or pats on the back on the contact page for the website, thehistoryoftheamericans.com, or by email at thehistoryoftheamericans@gmail.com. And please do me the great favor of giving the podcast a 5-star rating on Apple and following me on X for cranky musings on mostly history-related matters. Until next time.